Immerse yourself in Herbal Essence's new Moroccan Argan Oil Elixir, infused with pure argan oil. Just one drop delivers up to 100 hours of hair nourishment with the indulgent scent of a Moroccan garden. Herbal Essence's new Moroccan Argan Oil Elixir, spa quality hair repair without the price tag. Try it now. Herbal Essences. Surface repair to smoothness, nourishment with regimen use versus non-conditioning shampoo.
Babe, it's Gem. Just voice noting you because I'm so busy. I can't even type right now. I'm working on that big presentation for my new launch. I'm making it on Canva Mobile like you suggested. And it's making everything iconic. Sorry, it's a bit noisy, babes. Marbs is going off. Anyways, I'm going to ping the presentation to you now so you can see what I mean. Gotta go, hun. Thanks for introducing me to Canva. Love ya.
Hey guys, this is Sadia Khan and you are listening to Immigrantly. Before we get into today's episode, I want to tell you exactly why we are bringing this one back right now. I will be sharing a few statistics with you, so just bear with me. Recently, a report came out confirming something that honestly should stop all of us in our tracks. Nearly one in four Black households in this country are food insecure, more than double the rate of white households. And that gap isn't closing. It's getting worse. The biggest cuts to SNAP in the program's history are now in effect. That's the federal food assistance program that nearly 40 million Americans depend on to eat. A non-partisan estimate projects that 2.4 million people will lose food assistance as a result of expanded work requirements alone. And here's the part that haunts me. The government has announced it will no longer publish its annual report tracking food insecurity in America, which basically means going forward, we won't even have the data to see how bad it gets. And guys, the reality is, food's never been just food. It has always been about who has power, who writes the rules, and whose hunger gets counted. So the conversation you're about to hear with Chef Jenny Dorsey is one of the most honest ones I've ever had on this show. And it feels more urgent right now than when we first recorded it. If you are listening to it for the first time or the fifth, I think you need this one today. So without further ado, let's get right into it. And don't forget to come back next week for a new Immigrantly episode. Welcome, Jenny. I am so excited to have you on Immigrantly, and we are finally doing this after some logistical issues.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I am so sorry about last week.
No worries at all. I was really looking forward to it, and then we had some logistical issues with Riverside. It's not working. We are on Zoom. But other than that, I'm so excited. So you're based in Singapore these days, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it for pleasure, work? Have you moved there?
So it started as work. I came here as part of a fellowship with the U.S. government called Fulbright. So after I finished my master's, I applied for this grant so I could do some research here in Singapore. So I specifically wanted to research something called hawker centers here, which looked like, I guess to an American consumer, it would kind of be like an open air food court. Usually it's a combination of a food court and like a wet market. So you can buy fresh produce and meats and things. Some of them are just the food court. But essentially the way that they're used here is that they used to be street vendors that were roaming around, and that around the 70s, 80s, the government actually relocated them all indoors, even though it's still open air. And these are foods that I think not only do they constitute a lot of these very, what the government considers like traditional heritage foods of Singapore, there's a lot of interesting kind of history and culinary tradition we can talk about, but also they're very affordable. You can still get a meal for $3.50, $4, $5. So it's also a pretty important part of people being able to actually eat out prepared foods during the middle of the day or even as a family in a way that is affordable. You can go, you know, literally every day of the week if you have to. And they've done studies where people are eating at these hawker centers at least like 5 to 7 times a week, which is quite a lot compared to kind of dining out stats in the US.
When you say traditional Singaporean food, how do you define that? Give me an example.
I think when you say traditional anything food, right, it's always so difficult to really nail down. What does tradition mean? Who gets to define that? So I think what's tricky here in Singapore is that, first of all, it's quite a young country. It was technically founded in 1965, and it used to be part of Malaysia. And it has a lot of these influences from the different groups that immigrated here. So now, predominantly, the Singaporean population is like over 70% ethnically Chinese, but they're mostly from southern China. And there's like 3 different ethnic groups that kind of came to Singapore in those days. There's also a Malay population, and then the smallest population besides like kind of what the government lumps as other is the Indian population. There's about like, I think 10% roughly Indian population. It's really like an interesting mix of kind of these specific cultural foods that you would find in Singapore that actually, strangely enough, you wouldn't find in the hometowns of these people. So I'll give you an example. The classic chicken rice that everyone talks about in Singapore, it's called Hainanese chicken rice. But if you go to Hainan in China, they don't eat that there. That's not like a thing that they eat there. But the Hainan people came to Singapore and a lot of them kind of opened these restaurants and started making this food. And so now it's associated with them, but it's actually quite a context and location specific. Another example is like fish head curry, which obviously if you were eating it for the first time, you'd be like, oh, is this an Indian dish? But you also don't really find that in India. It's like an interesting mix of what Indian immigrants in Singapore were starting to make with fish heads to actually cater to the Chinese population. And there's actually 2 different versions. There's like an Indian version and a Chinese version. So again, both are quite specific to Singapore. So there's kind of been this interesting campaign that the government's been running for a while now of trying to classify these things as, you know, intangible heritage of Singapore. Where it gets really murky is, do you define as Singaporean? Do you define as Malaysian? Because a lot of these things came about when Singapore used to be Malaysia. And so a lot of these foods you also find in what is still Malaysia. So it's a contentious issue and people get up in arms about it because it's, first of all, it's nebulous, but also there's a lot of pride associated with it, not to mention a lot of propaganda about what it means to have traditional food.
Explain to me the propaganda side. Where does the propaganda come from?
The propaganda, I think a lot of like kind of food propaganda is about creating this idea of what the identity of that people is, whether that's a superior, inferior, whatever that is. A lot of it is related to how people eat. And your place in the world very much is kind of dictated by how your group of people eats. What cultural anthropologists have noticed over time, there's interesting fusion of information. But what they've also noticed is that when there's kind of groups of people that are next to each other, they often will define themselves by what they're not. So like they will refuse to adopt something that their nearby people do because they're like, we don't do this because that makes us different from those people.
So Jenny, when you say nearby people, are we talking about people within the same society?
I'm specifically thinking about like when cultural anthropologists were doing like kind of historical research, they were talking about, let's say, different indigenous tribes in the US that might have been in somewhat proximity to each other. Like definitely they were interacting, but they were very specific to not adopt certain things. Or different kingdoms, they were definitely trading with one another, but refused to pick up certain customs that they knew were happening, even if it might have been helpful for them. So given the kind of arbitrariness of geography and nations and what is a state anyway, that kind of has continued to blend into people within a certain nation as well. So you can also see it in different religions, right? We're different because we don't eat or do eat those things. Or even like within one ethnicity, it can be like, well, my family or my group doesn't do this. even though your group does.
You're absolutely right. And food is so specific to cultures, ethnicities, even people living within the same country, within the same society, may have very different eating habits. My husband and I always joke about this. He grew up in part of Pakistan, which has very specific cuisine. And when he and I got married, he expected me to know how to cook that cuisine. And I haven't still done that. And it's been 20 plus years. There is so much pride in food, but then there's a lot of gatekeeping as well. Going back to Singapore and its culture, is there a classification of how different foods are considered? For instance, Chinese versus Malaysian versus Indian. Is there a hierarchy?
I think in general, like, there is definitely a lot of, I would call it covert racism in Singaporean society. There's been many conversations, especially because elections happened this year, because demographically it's mostly Chinese, that like you would essentially say that the Chinese have white privilege here in society. They are the majority of people. They own most of the land. They make up most of the parliament seats. They have the most amount of money, et cetera, et cetera. And while the government has constantly pushed this idea of a multi-harmonious, multicultural society, which in ways it has succeeded. There are plenty of holidays, public holidays that are across all the faiths, across all the kind of ethnic demographics. But at the same time, are they all observed or given the same sort of respect or the same amount of time off is another thing. It's much more covert, I would say, than the US, where it's, especially now, there is kind of this like attempt, but is that enforced? Not so much. When it comes to food, I think what's tricky is that if you ask any Singaporean, regardless of their race, at least like in my experience, most people will have pretty good things to say about foods from all three, at least of those cultures, because they don't see it so much as Chinese. They wouldn't call Chinese Singaporean dish Chinese food. They would call it Singaporean food. If you have roti prata, you would not call that an Indian dish. That would be a Singaporean dish as well, right? So there's kind of this, because everything gets lumped under the Singaporean umbrella, it's easier to say like there's an affinity towards that. However, that doesn't mean there are still covert things that happen. So for example, there's a lot of conversation about there's too much salt and sugar in the food. I mean, I think worldwide we're having just an excess of salt and sugar because so much processed food. And so there's been a campaign all about like how you should reduce your salt intake, but the foods that are listed as being really salty, right, they tend to skew towards certain demographics of food. And that's not that like the Chinese Singaporean food isn't there. There's kind of this undercurrent. You would have to, and this is what gets tricky, is that when you point it out, there's always going to be a lot of naysayers like, but there is a food, you can feel the framing. You can feel that there is something else to be said about like, oh, well, that food is, it's saltier or it's less healthy. It's more greasy. There's kind of this insinuation, even if it's not stated outright. And so that's what's the, at least as a, especially as an outsider researcher in food, this is a topic that gets very touchy very quickly.
Jenny, I want to go back to your work. You are a chef. You've done so much research within food space. You've talked about food in ways that really make us think, at least take a pause and think about how we see food, not just something we consume physically, but also the emotional connection that people have with food. And there's something that a lot of us often call food, right? Food is a great connector. But you have a very different interpretation of the word connector or food used as a tool for connection. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think food is, of course, it is a great connector, but it also does so much more than that. I don't want to call it a conspiracy because that gives it this bad framing, but there's a concerted effort, this kind of marketing effort that kind of confines food to this idea that it's very happy, it's this great thing, we're all gathered around the table breaking bread. And that really masks a lot of the not only detrimental, but very powerful aspects of food. And power can be good and bad. And a lot of times it can be misused in all sorts of ways that we don't like. And food is incredibly powerful. And food has been used to break apart, you know, social ties, but also create an idea of a nation. And food has been certainly used as justification for harming people. It is also a way that we are able to come together or in times of like great need, help each other. So I think it's not so much that we need to dismiss that food is a connector, but we have to see that it's balanced out by so many. It's much more nuanced than that. It's much more holistic.
What gets lost if we focus on food as a connector?
I think you actually limit the idea that food can not only have great power, but also is really actively shaping your worldview. Food is really giving you a lens in which you're thinking about the world. And it's not just, oh, I like to eat with my friend, right? Like, the fact that when you're at home, who cooks for you? Who should do the cooking? Just as something as small as that. I know, yes, we're trying to work on breaking gender norms and stuff, but the reality is across the globe, the majority of cooking is done by women at home. And that is not, first of all, that's not paid. So then that introduces a whole other thing, right? When you think about like GDP, when you think about a segment like the food industry is very big. But guess what's not included in that? Women's labor at home. That's certainly not part of the food industry. So that's already a whole thing to talk about, not to mention fine dining, which is almost predominantly white male chefs in positions of power, despite the fact that the expectation at home, and also not even at home, just in general, is that women cook, right? Like, what is happening there? When there's a professionalization, when there's any sort of kind of like worth and external value attached to food, then suddenly the locus of that shifts outside of women. So there's so much that is happening, and that is all kind of contributing to our ideas of what women should do. For example, what my relationship to my partner should be, who should be doing the housework at home. I mean, these are fairly, I think, basic examples I hope people can grasp. And that, like, just that in and of itself is something about our perspective that is being shaped by food before we're maybe even conscious of it.
But food also brings so much culture. It brings heritage. There is a strong connection between food and personal identity, especially for immigrants. There are moments when I'm craving something that I grew up eating in Pakistan, or it transports me to those moments of, you know, being in the kitchen with my family. But then there is this fine line between heritage and commodification of food, which you've talked about, especially in professional spaces that are mostly dominated by male chefs. How do you, as a chef, navigate the line between heritage and resisting its commodification? Or is commodification okay if it's done within certain limits?
I think it's more like, on whose terms is anything getting said? Who gets to benefit from whatever is happening? When we talk about instances of cultural appropriation, what I always try to point people to is when we live in an unequal society, when certain groups have more power than others, we're always going to have instances of appropriation, because appropriation at its core, it could be inspiration, but because there's power involved, then it can turn into appropriation. So anyway, I think back to your question is, navigating all of that is ultimately asking the questions about who has power in this exchange and why. And is there anything I can do to resist that? Is there anything I can do to subvert that? Is there something I can do to also sometimes just remove myself from that, you know, not grant them access to my culture, not grant them access to me as a token for my culture? That is often not the most desired state for a lot of people, but sometimes removing yourself from the equation can be an act of resistance as well.
Jenny, how do we differentiate between that, which you're defining as act of resistance, and gatekeeping? And I'll give you an example of the food that I cook in my house is pretty much based on all the recipes that were passed down to me from my mother, my grandmother, my husband's mother. And there have been moments where any tweaking of those recipes has been problematic, right? For me, at least. And I've always said, oh, this is not how this dish should be cooked. And in my mind, I'm preserving the culture and the heritage that's been passed down to me. But I also feel I am gatekeeping in a way, because who is to define or who determines what the actual or the authentic recipe may look like? And you know what I'm saying, right? It's like, how do we make that determination of what is authentic, whether it's recipe, the ingredients that are used, the way and the manner in which we consume that food?
I think the big questions here are, who has power and what's the context? I always like to talk about authenticity as like a point of view at a point in time. So then who has the power to determine in what context this recipe is authentic? Is that you? Is that your husband? Is that your mother-in-law? Is that your mother? And who has granted them that power? And let's say it's an editor of a magazine and they're taking your recipe and they unilaterally decide to edit it, and then they don't talk about, they don't have footnotes on why they changed it. Then again, they have power and they've decided to completely shift the context and present a very different version of like what is quote-unquote authentic. Also kind of commodifying your identity as part of that. So that is, I think, where we get to very problematic areas. But especially when it's about allowing something to evolve with the person, my stance is that that's very different. You are allowed to cook things that are how you like them, right? Maybe your mom liked it this way, but you prefer it with this or that. There's lots of things that my mother like loves in a particular way, but we just have a slightly different kind of like palate. And I think that's okay. If it's important to you to kind of preserve the earlier version, that's something to keep notes of or keep it somewhere. But I don't think it's necessarily bad for you to be changing it, nor do I think it's necessarily bad for you to be telling other people not to change your version.
Do you see a lot of judgment in terms of, again, how food is consumed, how food is prepared? Because food brings out such visceral emotional reactions, people are really invested in food itself. And maybe because of that, there is more judgment on others.
I think because food is very closely tied to our identity, the way we see ourselves. And again, I think because we have by and large kind of ignored the ways that food has already shaped, like really entrenched itself into our worldview and helped us develop that worldview, that people get very defensive about food, especially when you challenge them or you negate them or something like that. Partially because, yes, you know, it's very visceral. It might have an intense family connection, personal, but also because there's these kind of like invisible ties of what food has taught you about your place in the world, your station in the world, your social standing that maybe you have not actually consciously identified. But when suddenly someone makes that clear or renounces it or something, then you have a really intense reaction and you might not even know why.
How has food changed your worldview from what it was?
Food has given me a way to realize that validate actually a lot of things I was feeling but didn't understand. An example I give often is just this kind of feeling somehow inferior in culinary school, but not really knowing why. And then realizing it's not just the fact that French cuisine is kind of heralded as like it's the supreme, but it's also the intense amount of racism and classism and sexism all across US society. And then there's not even getting to the layer of like the way we tell history is extremely subjective. We'd say like, oh, the French, they have these amazing, thoughtful, meticulous dishes. And I mean, I am Chinese. I watch Chinese period dramas. It has really opened my eyes to just how narrow of a vision that often in the education system, in our general society, if you don't push beyond those bounds, like you will go through the world kind of with blinders on. And that is the point of indoctrination, that's the point of propaganda. And food is one way to start seeing where those kind of that indoctrination breaks down.
Have you unraveled any truths through this process that may have been painful?
I think the hardest one is always especially as, you know, you cannot stop eating food, you can't just decide it's a messed up system, is realizing that we are all kind of complicit in this system. And as a matter of the fact that when we're complicit, we have to figure out like what are our boundaries? Like there's no perfect way to eat. You can't buy yourself out of a lose-lose situation that we're all kind of in. So then what does it mean to me to be as good of a person within this food system, within a very flawed food system that I can? And that's, I mean, I'm still on that journey. I'm still figuring it out. And I think it really depends for every person.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about your pop-up, Asian in America. Where do you use virtual reality, poetry, and food, of course, to explore racialized experiences? What did you learn about how people respond to discomfort when it's really served on a plate, when that discomfort is communicated through food?
I think one of the funny things about wanting people to feel uncomfortable, but also, you know, they're paying for a dining experience, is this internal struggle of, should certain things taste bad? That was like a true question I really grappled with, is like, should certain things be like extremely bitter, right? Should certain things be extremely difficult to eat? Should I make the process super onerous where I give purposely difficult utensils, like a really, really small fork, and make them eat something difficult? Like there's a lot of things that I was like grappling with. But overall, what I think I really realized about that experience is, even if you know of a concept, like let's say the model minority myth in abstraction, you kind of like understand the theory, maybe you heard about it in class, I think it's another thing to be able to not only talk about it with someone who might have experienced it. So there's an in-person communal nature of eating together, because we're all group dining, but also being able to hear someone's story and kind of like ingest it, so to speak, quite literally, that I think gives you, I hope, a pathway to understanding that a little bit more deeply. And seeing people grapple with discomfort, you really start seeing what comes out when people are unfamiliar with feeling uncomfortable. There are people who probably felt uncomfortable because that was not their lived experience, but they have felt discomfort in many other scenarios before because of whatever, you know, lived experience they've had. And so maybe everybody has, you know, different kind of like natural reactions, but often the reaction might be something more along the lines of curiosity or quietness, versus what I often also saw was lashing out or getting upset.
Give me an example.
I think making underhanded comments, vehemently denying the experience of someone at the table, or getting frustrated, feeling personally attacked. There is a lot that everyone could have learned about themselves in that particular experience as well. That was interesting for me to observe. Not that I'm a psychologist. I feel like I really learned about someone non-verbally.
You know, this is such an important point, because we are talking about the audience here, right? Do you ever worry that your most powerful messages about inequity, appropriation, or identity are sometimes being consumed by people who are already aligned with you? And when they are not aligned, the response is not what you expected? Like, how do you take that feedback?
I think a lot of times it's much easier to find the people that agree with you, especially in this social media day and age, the kinds of people that not only will follow me on social media, but come to an event, right, is self-selecting. There's like multiple obstacles for them to get into, like, butt and see. So that's already like a filter. But let's say you are really interacting with someone who's totally new, and that has happened sometimes, like an event series will invite us. It is truly like a new audience. It is still valid to hear their complaints, or if they're offended by something, frustrated by something, felt attacked by something. Like, I think it's helpful to hear that. But again, sometimes discomfort is the point. So it's okay if their response was discomfort. So I think trying to remember that and trying not to be a people pleaser.
Idle money lies in your current account, picking crumbs out of its belly button, wondering, Should I eat them? But when you start investing with Monzo, your money's always busy. It turns on regular investments, invests your spare change, and tops up your stocks and shares ISA. It even helps you make sense of risk and return. Monzo, the bank that gets your money moving. You could get back less than you invest. Monzo current account required. UK residents 18 plus. T's and C's apply.
Jenny, you mentioned model minority myth. I do want to go back to that. How has it shown up in your professional life? And how have you tried to dismantle it through your work?
Yeah, I think it's very tricky because it's hard to point out when someone is doing that, like, because it's often a compliment to people who look like me, especially if you're East Asian, right? You're the one who gets the upside of the quote unquote upside of the model minority myth. If you have a white colleague, often, especially if it's a senior person, it's kind of like hearing them lavish you with praise, but while negging someone else on the team. And that's usually how I had encountered it, especially professionally, both, you know, in kitchens as well as in corporate spaces. And that is a very difficult situation to try and dismantle things, which a lot of times, you know, the feedback I do hear, and I very much agree with, is sometimes you're just not in a position to do anything, especially if you are not the person on the totem pole. So again, I think like we're in a lose-lose situation a lot of the time. So figuring out like what is the change or what is the difference I can make. For me personally, when it comes to the model minority myth, it's been about trying to do the work to educate other Asian Americans who look like me, who are naturally kind of going to gravitate to be willing to listen to what I have to say, and trying to get them to rethink about their patterns, because I know I actually do have influence over them, or at least have some measure of influence, more so than I might have over, you know, a boss at work. So how do you also reach into your own community and say, hey, look at how this has been dividing us. Look at how this pits us against other people. Look at how this has historically stoked so much anger and hatred in our community, and is continuing to do so. There was a whole spate of a lot of anger during the anti-Asian stuff during COVID, and people were pushing for a lot of increased hate crime legislation. And it took a lot of activists and a lot of educators in the Asian American community to talk about like why that's probably not going to help Asian Americans or minorities in general. Because in general, when there are harsher penal codes, the people who suffer are never white Americans. It's always minorities. Instead of pushing for harsher laws, what are the other things that we can push for?
You've talked about the hurt that food can cause. And in your TED talk, you share personal experience regarding that. Can you share that with us here?
Yeah, for sure. I'll just say, funnily enough, after I did that TED talk, my mother watched it. And she said, wow, I didn't know that story. And I just remembered you coming back from that camp and being really sad, but you didn't say why. So essentially the story is I'm like six-ish around that time. And I had gone to this like sleepaway camp. It was, I don't know if it was my first time away from parents. It must've been an early time away from parents. And I don't know why I got signed up for this like summer camp thing. Anyway, we go into the woods, we're like in these cabins, and for dinner we have this like assembly line situation. You get the tray and then, you know, you go down like a lunch line, and you go get different things. And I had gotten a slice of ham. It was like a pretty thick cut ham, and I have never seen it before. I did not know what this alien thing was. I had no idea how to eat it. And it was huge, right? And it kind of flops over my plate. And it's like this weird color. You know, sometimes ham have that like slightly green sheen to them. Anyway, so I'm totally floored. You know, I don't know what's going through my six-year-old mind. And I get a fork. I'm handed like a fork and a knife and a spoon, presumably, at some point. And I just stick my fork into the ham. And I'm like, you know, I'm like trying to eat it on the side. It's wild. And I'm just thinking, this is like, how does anyone eat this thing? I'm totally confused. And my teacher sees this. And I think the thing that really stuck with me all these years is that she is angry. She's really angry and she's mad at me. And I am so confused by the anger. You know, I don't know how to process it because I don't understand the genesis of it, nor do I understand what could she be possibly mad about. And she makes an example of me in front of everyone saying, like, we don't eat like this, right? We. And when she says we, it's very clear to me that she's not talking about, but technically I'm included in the we. Like if we are all in the space together.
It's very racialized.
Right. It's a very clear that when she says we, I am the non-we and everyone else is the we and I am the person that they're not supposed to be, right? And my English isn't great then. English is not my first language. And so, you know, I'm confused and all this stuff, but I can still really could feel that, hang on to that, like, feeling of just shame, of just knowing that I'm not supposed to be here and somehow the act of eating in a way that was confusing to me, but I was doing my best, had made that really visible, so visible that someone not only could call me out and make an example, but have an emotional reaction to.
Has your understanding of that moment changed now when you look back from shame to something else?
I don't know if it's changed. It's still like quite a formative moment, I think, in terms of the food journey that I've been on. You know, I didn't know it then, right? But I would be talking about it many years later as the intro to this a talk. And I think what it has given me is a very easy, maybe easy is the wrong word, but it's a way that when I tell that story and I looked out into the crowd, you know, they're the people that understood that feeling. I didn't really have to finish the story, right? Like halfway through the story, I could just see the people who have experienced something similar, their eyes, they're like, oh, I know where this is going. I think that that has given me an understanding of like how very common it is for us to feel shame and how much we don't, how painful that is and how deeply entwined that is with food. So I guess it's given me that connection that I'm like grateful for. But I think something that I've been able to analyze, you know, now that I'm an adult now, about this part of a teacher being angry is like her anger, I think, means that something about my behavior she was internalizing as some sort of reflection on her, whether it's her ability to teach, her ability to manage children, I don't know. But like there was something that it was somehow stirring in her that made her want to lash out. Because as you know, psychologists say, anger is a secondary emotion. So it's masking the primary emotion. I cannot say definitively what that is.
But it may just have been simple racism. Why do you think it's more complicated than that?
Well, I think even with racism, it's like, why? What about racism in that sense made her angry? Was it that I was impinging on her space, that I was? And so what about that was threatening to her? Because she's clearly in the position of power, right? In many ways, I am subservient. I'm a 6-year-old and she's an adult. So like, that's actually in a racist society, it's ideal. You have the person that you don't deem inferior is inferior to you. So then what did I do that somehow challenged or threatened this dynamic in a way that would make her angry? Because racists are angry when you do something that they feel is not right, quote unquote, challenges the norm. So yeah, that's what I always like reflect on or think about, or something that I would love to know, but I don't think I ever will.
And again, sitting here, we can only speculate. You've not had that conversation with your teacher. I don't even know your teachers. We are just, you know, inferring what could it be. When I listened to your TED Talk, my first reaction was she just felt that the space was not created for you and you did not have the right to be there. It was created for white kids. And the only thing she could do was lash out on your behavior because it probably gave her a reason to validate her thought process, I guess. So she othered you in that instant, not because of how you were behaving, but because she felt that you didn't deserve to be there.
It was predominantly white, and it was also a religious camp. I don't know why I was there because my parents have never been religious. So many questions on why I was at this camp to begin with. But I think in many ways, she probably felt the same as why are you here.
You know, sometimes when these things happen, especially when we are children and we have these entrenched memories of sadness or trauma, for me, when I look back, I always think, I wish I could talk to that person, right, and resolve it. I'm somebody who tries to resolve everything. Have you ever thought of reaching out to her?
No, I have no idea who she is.
Oh, you don't even remember.
I don't remember. But for people that I actually have had conflict that I remember who they are, yes, I am also very pro attempting to resolve. And also realizing that sometimes attempting to resolve is more for me than for them. And so then I'm like, okay, I might as well just try. And then if what they say, no, they don't want to resolve, that's fine. But it'll make me feel better that I try. So I am also pro resolution, pro attempt at resolution.
How do you see Ham?
Ham now? I actually quite like Ham. I like Ham with a bone in it. I'm a pro bone Ham. I really don't mind Ham. I mean, I obviously don't like it when it's dry. I don't have like any sort of bad associations with Ham. I have a few things I like prefer not to eat. And one of them is peas, because I remember having to pick peas out of fried rice a lot. And all fried rice that you, for whatever reason, had like peas. And I just don't. Yeah, that was very burdensome and frustrating. And that gives me like frustration, and I don't like peas. And also because peas legitimately don't taste great. Like once they're plucked, and you know, the sugar is turning to starch, they don't taste very good. A fresh pea, of course, delicious, but by and large, the peas we are eating, not so good. So I would say peas, dislike. Ham, fine.
Let's talk about authenticity. We started the conversation with how food evokes all these different emotions. We talked about authenticity in cooking, recipes. Authenticity itself and authentic is such a loaded term, right? As you said, it means different things to different people. But food has also become a way to express yourself through Instagram and TikTok. In the world of Instagrammable dishes and viral food trends, we see food has taken on a new space. How do you see authenticity now when we are posting filtered pictures of food at restaurants and all these fine dining spaces and projecting them to be part of our normal living?
Yeah, and that's before we even get into like AI-generated images and touch-ups and stuff. So as I was saying, I like to think of authenticity as like a point of view at a point in time. So what is it that when someone says, this is authentic, or that was an authentic experience or whatever, like what is it that they are actually trying to say to you with fewer words, so to speak? What is the context in which they're trying to communicate that to you? What is the way that they maybe perhaps see themselves that they're also trying to communicate to you? A lot of times, especially in the US, when people say like, oh, this is a really like authentic experience. And then they're kind of actually using that as like it was an experience that I feel like if they go to a new neighborhood, for example, right? In New York, a lot of, unfortunately, TikTokers will go to Flushing and they'll go to a place like White Bear, which is great. I love White Bear, but they have dumplings if you haven't been. Last time I went, it's not the nicest space. It's kind of dingy. You know, the tables are not perhaps a little sticky, but they have these like great dumplings served probably on styrofoam, and the chili sauce is quite spicy, whatever. And people are like, oh, I went to Flushing and I had this really authentic experience at this place. And so what I really want, I hope that I can encourage people to start thinking about when they hear that is that, like, what is the context in which White Bear, they placed White Bear that was like suitably authentic to them? Because they had an image of Flushing. They had an image of what the food in Flushing should taste like. And when they went to White Bear, those things like matched up, right? And then they were like, this is on, yes. And then this is authentic. Versus if you go to, you know, whatever, there's plenty of high-end things in Flushing. And that's probably been there for a long time, you know, fancy seafood Cantonese place. But rarely do people go and be like, oh, this was a really authentic Flushing experience. Why? Because they already have a context of Flushing that they are trying to communicate to you. I think there's a certain unintended laziness in that communication that we're constantly sort of trying to fight in the food media space, or I think many, you know, especially writers of colors are trying to fight in the food media space because it doesn't really say anything. And also, if you're assuming that people can understand what that authenticity means, it means you're probably writing to an audience that is very similar to you. And then what does that mean? The lack of diversity in the audience and the writers, and that's a whole other conversation. So yes, back to the conversation about authenticity is, I think the question is like, what are you actually trying to say? And how come we don't have the words for that in this social media day and age? What is it that is making it so difficult for us to, I mean, I know why we don't like using words, because we're kind of punished for using too many words on social media. But what is making it so hard for so many creators to more thoughtfully describe what they're experiencing versus using authentic?
If not authentic, Jenny, then what? Give me a word.
I think it's like, what are you trying to describe? This was something that I had seen before. What that is, it captures like a part of what immigrants might have experienced when they first moved here. Or there's a reason that this shop is located where it is, because like, I think it requires so much more explanation. But like, why do we have cabbage here? Or why don't we use certain spices here? When someone says, oh, you added this thing, so no, it's no longer authentic. So then it's like, why is that? It's because this spice maybe people weren't using it in this part of the world at the time that this dish was invented. I think it's like, there's a little bit of history. There's more explanation that is required, as opposed to, I don't know if it's like a descriptive thing. It's more of a explanation sort of thing.
I love how you look at food as a chef, but then as a thinker as well. Is there ever a conflict?
Yes, of course. I think it's very hard. As a chef, you're always trying to make things taste really good. And also you're trying to please your guests. You're trying to make sure that they come back and have this experience. And then as someone who wants people to be more critical in terms of critical analysis of food, they don't have to be more critical of food. Sometimes feeding them what they want, figuratively or literally, is not the best way to do that, right? Teachers can't give you the answer to your test. They have to prompt you to do it on your own. And that is not exactly, especially in a fine dining setting, it's like the whole point of, I think, a lot of people when they go to fine dining is that they get waited on hand and foot. You get to feel like the king and queen for the day. But that is the kind of experience that, unfortunately, Michelin and World's 50 and whatever has curated in people's minds of a authentic, right, Michelin starred experience, is that people are like falling over themselves to make sure that you are comfortable. And that comfort is not a place where you do a lot of learning. So how to get people to learn, but also make them feel like they had a good meal. Because also comfort is often when you have good feelings of eating, right? Comfort food. When you're relaxed and comfortable, things generally psychologically tend to taste better. So yeah, there's a lot of tension there.
What I've dedicated my life to is revenge.
A brand new drama based on the best-selling novel.
They think they're better than us.
Who do you think you are?
I'm going to prove to them that they're wrong.
She's punishing me.
You destroyed my family. I will not rest until I've destroyed yours.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4. Stream now.
There once was a woman who lived in a shoe. A size too snug, but what could she do? But that's not where her story ends. Thanks to a little help from her Experian friends, she got her score into much better shape and relocated to a box-fresh new place with room to grow and a mortgage to suit. Now, she lives in a spacious 4-bedroom cowboy boot. Better your Experian credit score to help get mortgage ready. Experian. Better your score. Better your story.
Jenny, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of different kinds of food and their relationship with society, how would you do that?
All the foods that we generally associate with the U.S. Is immigrant food, And then if you expand beyond that, it's a lot of Black food waste, a lot of Indigenous food waste, a lot of Asian food waste, a lot of Latin food. It's food waste of the people that came to the Americas. And those paths were not equal. And I think that's also important to recognize, is that, you know, all food might be fusion at this point, but not all fusion is equal, because not all types of relationships were equal. So I think the U.S. food is like America. It's just, it's a really complicated, it's complicated and it's painful. And but it's also like, wow, the fact that we have been able to create very interesting, delicious, great foods is like a testament that, like, when people persevere, we do great things. I like to believe that when people persevere, even through one of my friends, Hawa Hassan, just came out with a book about wartime and food and displacement and food. Even in the most awful of situations, people make food and culinary traditions through that. And that is, I think the cornerstone of like humankind. Actually, there's a great quote from, now I can't remember which book, but they talked about how cooking is inherently what makes us human, because only humans are the only animal that cook their food. No one else, all the other animals eat it raw, right? No one is like lighting a little fire. So cooking is something of what defines humanity and humankind. And I think that's very cool.
Thank you so much, Jenny. This was great. Where can people find you? On Instagram.
You can find me on Instagram, on TikTok, on LinkedIn. I'm not really on Facebook, but I do have a profile. Yes, at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And then I have a newsletter called Way Too Complicated on Substack.
I love it. Thank you so much for this great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was so good. We talked about food, but in a different way, from it being a connector, but then also causing pain. What really struck me and stuck with me is this idea of being uncomfortable, and how when we are uncomfortable is when we learn. That's when we evolve. And for that to happen, it is so important for us to be not scared of being uneasy. So next time, if you are uncomfortable, remember, you may be learning something new, something extraordinary, something invaluable. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation. Until then, take care and be safe. Thank you.